Distributing the future broadcast May 15th. Collaboration constraints.
The future is going to be bigger than the past. There's going to be more happening. Connected systems, connected devices, connected data. What can we do in that world that will be interesting, powerful, and useful?
Changing the world through capturing the knowledge of innovators.
The future is here. It's just not evenly distributed yet.
Welcome to Distributing the Future from O'Reilly Media. I'm Daniel Steinberg, and each week we bring you the technology and the people behind what you use now and what you'll use next. Mitch Kapoor says that what makes the Wikipedia work isn't the technology. It's the vision, the values, and the community. Chromatic tells us what his dream computer language would and would not have. And Chris Adamson explains why some types of television shows have long-running story arcs and others are self-contained. I'm looking at the IM status of a friend of mine, and it shows that he's listening to Clapton's Bell Bottom Blues. A shared context brings a smile to my face. I can hear the opening notes of the guitar solo. Tasty. My parents don't really like the music that I listened to as a kid, and I'm not really hot on the music that my daughter listens to. It's all about context. It's all what we're comfortable with. So imagine you're reading the newspaper, and you see an article with a fact that doesn't seem right to you. You put the paper down, and you confirm that you're correct. You make a quick call to the newspaper office and go back to your favorite chair and pick the paper back up and continue reading. You glance at the paragraph with the misinformation and note with a satisfied smile that it's been corrected. Oh, and there's also a cross-reference to another article that you might be interested in reading. Freaky? Impossible? Impractical? Well, maybe, but that's only because of the physical limitations. Online, this is the world of the Wikipedia, and the reference books and magazines and newspapers that your parents know and love aren't embracing it. Mitch Kapoor is, the founder of Lotus and the president and chair of the Open Source Applications Foundation, spoke on the benefits of the Wikipedia. He started by acknowledging the notion that
the Wikipedia can't possibly work is absolutely the standard response from any intelligent, educated person who has never used it. They can't believe it's a serious thing when you say this is an encyclopedia written entirely by volunteers, which is completely open. This intuition that it can't possibly work is fueled by some of the press coverage of it, because the mainstream media has been quite skeptical about it. So it will take an issue like a few months ago, somebody down in Tennessee kind of as a joke edited the entry on a guy named John Siegenthaler, who is a publisher, newspaper publisher and former aide to Robert F. Kennedy, and edited his entry to say that he was alleged to have been involved in a conspiracy to kill President Kennedy or something like that, which was like completely untrue. And this fact actually stayed in the Wikipedia for several months until it was discovered and then removed. And the mainstream media seized on it in a way to say, see, ha, this stuff really doesn't work. This is almost a Zen koan that we have to wrestle with. If it seems like it can't possibly work, but it does, then we have to come up with an explanation that makes sense to people as to why something that is seemingly so counterintuitive actually does work. Anyone can edit any article at any time. Well, when you tell this to somebody that is not familiar with it, I can see their blood pressure rising and them starting to freak out at this point, because it feels dangerous. It feels uncontrolled. It feels like it engenders mistrust. If anyone can edit any article at any time, then somebody could, you know, write, you know, anything about anybody. And how could you possibly sort of take that seriously? This is really very radical. Not anybody can just patch the Linux kernel and have it go into the next build. I mean, this is more open than open source software, because the large open source projects, as we well know, have had to develop various systems of review, in some cases multi-level review. You submit a patch and it gets reviewed, and different projects, of course, have very different processes. But yet the Wikipedia somehow, at least to date, has managed not to have that. You can go and change the article and it's in, it's done, it's there. Well, there are some myths, I think, that the radical openness of the Wikipedia just gives the lie to. Here's the first idea that it challenges, which is if you want to have a project, someone has to be in charge. There is this unbelievably deep-seated idea that authority is required to guarantee quality. Wikipedia challenges that notion. Now, if we're from the open source world, we already understand that the strong form, someone has to be in charge, isn't true. Otherwise, our projects wouldn't work. There's another myth. If you don't have the experts involved, how can you possibly trust the information? And this, I think, is even more central. It's some imprinting that we grow up with. Deep-seated, unconscious assumptions that you have to have certified authorities in order to maintain order and quality. Does it bring out our fear that radical openness is going to lead to chaos and anarchy? It's a perpetual improvement opportunity under the right set of circumstances. And the more radically open a system is, the greater is that opportunity for improvement, for error correction, for greater quality, and for the advancement of the entire body. There was another well-publicized controversy about Wikipedia involving a study done by Nature, in which they compared the quality of articles on a variety of scientific topics from Wikipedia and the Britannica. And they did this by sending them out to experts on the subjects. They selected a set of articles. They removed information that would make it easy to identify whether the articles that were being compared were what source they were from. And then they asked these experts to count the number of mistakes in those two. Britannica had nearly as many mistakes as Wikipedia. Of course, Britannica totally went on the warpath about this, and to the extent of taking out half-page ads in the New York Times, kind of challenging the methodology. The point is that all of the mistakes and issues in the Wikipedia were fixed the next day. So if they reran the study, it would win hands down. And the next time they did that study, even if Britannica were much better, and Jimmy Wales himself says that what he said was, it's lucky they picked the science articles, because our science articles are pretty good. There are lots of areas from the Wikipedia that would have picked where our quality is still really terrible. But the fact is, when the problems are brought to light, instead of it being an occasion of embarrassment or shame, it accelerates the process of improving the quality. They go right in and fix it. And we are just not used to this. We haven't incorporated it into our kind of cultural unconsciousness. Wikipedia is fundamentally not a technology project. It is a community project. It is the community of participants who make the thing go. And they are not organized as an anthill. They're not organized as a market. But it is a social arrangement in which people are tied together. And you could tell this because people self-identify as Wikipedians. The community has a number of important attributes and dimensions, one of which is it actually started with a vision. And vision is very important. Vision is, where are we trying to get to? A free encyclopedia of the world's knowledge for the world's people in their own languages. That has been articulated by Jimmy Wales and by others for many years. Out of the vision arises the mission. The mission of the Wikipedia is to reach the vision, but to do it in this all-volunteer, radically open kind of way. Values are important. Values meaning what people hold in common, what is important about the Wikipedia as a community. You know, values have a very bad reputation. Values are something that you do on your in your spare time. Business is about making money and check your values at the door. Part of the reason Wikipedia and things like it are important is it also challenges that radical separation. It suggests not only can you get big things done and keep your values, but the values are critical to getting the thing done. So what are the values? Oh, they're profound things like be nice. It's amazing how much mileage they get out of be nice. Be nice, I mean, it means be respectful. It means make your opponent's case for him or her. There are disputes and arguments all over the place about this article and that and the other. But the norm in the Wikipedia, which is repeated over and over again, is that the right thing to do is to find the parts of your opponent's point of view that you can agree with and edit them in yourself. So rather than the kind of shouting, bullying, chair throwing, I have a bigger IQ than you and I can scream louder that has driven companies like Microsoft to the top, it does not work 100% of the time by any means. But it only needs to work well enough to provide coherence to hold the thing together through those times when people get very disputatious. Another value, neutral point of view. It means what Wikipedians believe in is the facts, is having a neutral point of view and presenting that information. There's a whole set of practices revolving around the fact that you're not supposed to just criticize, you're supposed to improve. So if you see a problem, fix it. If you don't know how to fix it, go to the article's talk page and just note, I think this is a problem here for the following reasons. I don't know how to fix it, but maybe somebody else does. So, you know, do what you can do to make it better. Don't complain. I think there will be lots of business opportunities. One thing that has happened is that Jimmy Wales, who's the founder, and a bunch of other people have created this thing called Wikia, which is a sort of roll-your-own Wikipedia for anybody who wants to set up something like it, like the ultimate Barbie site or the ultimate Star Wars sites, where they will have 1,000 times as much information about Star Wars or pick your subject as would go in a general encyclopedia like the Wikipedia, but want to build and assemble a community. I expect medical, health information, all kinds of reference information to be the low-hanging fruit. But wherever having an ever-evolving, ever more accurate body of knowledge has economic value, having a Wikipedia-like community and arrangement, in my mind, has to be seen as the most obvious candidate for adding value and possibly for starting. Bill Joy, founder of Sun Microsystems, said, most of the smart people in the world don't work for you. And it's certainly true in software, but when it comes to general knowledge, it's dramatically true. And so I think that's the model that's going to win. We are very imperfect beings. We are always going to screw up. Individually and collectively. Part of the reason I get aggravated at people like Ray Kurzweil and talking about the singularity, it's a kind of a religious, it's all going to be better. It's technologists' form of the rapture. I don't believe it. The best we can do is to have radically open systems based on respect that always have the possibility of improvement and recovery from our inevitable errors. Thank you.
The Open Source Applications Foundation's Mitch Kapoor speaking at the MySQL conference on the Wikipedia. Chromatic is an O'Reilly online editor who specializes in programming, Linux, and open source development. He's so quiet and deadpan that sometimes people miss how funny he is. Even in print, his humor is often subtle enough to slip under the radar. Here we take a more serious look at what features of a language affect its maintainability. Chromatic's list includes learnability, consistency, simplicity, comprehensiveness, power, and its enforcement of good programming practices. He considers what he might do if he could just start from scratch.
Well, if I were to design another programming language, It would be to address the frustrations I have with all of the existing programming languages I've used. They don't let me do what I want the way I want to do it. I think Perl 5 does a lot of what I want, but trying to do a lot of advanced things in Perl, you really see the machinery coming through. And, you know, it's nice to have it there rather than in a language that's a little safer, like maybe Visual Basic or C++ or even Haskell. But it's very frustrating because it's the raw machinery. And there aren't a lot of escape hatches built into language. It's not like a Lisp or a Scheme where you have this nice macro system, you have this regular syntax, and you can build abstractions on top of that. Of course, my problem with Lisp and Scheme is they don't have any syntax. And you get above a program of a certain size, and I can't see it anymore. I have high hopes for Perl 6. I guess what I'm looking for is a language that gets out of my way when it doesn't need to be in my way, but lets me escape it when I really need to. A lot of the Ruby people, a lot of the Rails people say, well, we've created a domain-specific language. And, yeah, to some extent, Ruby lets you manipulate the syntax a little bit, but in any large programming project, you're creating an API. You're effectively creating a mini-language there yourself. Your function calls are your verbs, your variables are your nouns, and anybody who's going to come along and maintain that project or work on it later is going to have to learn your mini-language anyway. Now, it may look a heck of a lot like your normal language, or in the case of Lisp or Scheme, it may look like the normal programming language, but you already have a domain-specific language. Part of the goal of Perl 6, I think, is you have malleable grammar, and you can manipulate it in only the parts you want to affect. Lexically scoped malleable grammar, for example. So if I write a library and you write a library, you don't have to know that I'm changing the grammar in my library. You know, maybe the case is for experienced programmers or for people who like to dabble and tinker that all of us should be writing our own languages. It's already the case in English or probably other languages that when you get a group of professionals together, they develop their own jargon, they develop their own shorthand. If you or I were to work in the insurance industry, for example, we'd have to learn a whole bunch of new terms and a lot of ideas, and they probably have a lot of shortcuts they'd be talking about. We wouldn't have any idea what's going on. And it's probably the case for this kind of software we'd have to develop for that group. The most important thing you can do is make a programming language that makes it easy for novices to maintain a complex program written in the language, even if they've never programmed before, even if they don't have any domain knowledge there. I think the way people talk about maintainability, the way people talk about ease of use, has really a weird skew towards novices. I don't know why that is. I mean, obviously it's noble to want people to be able to learn your programming language. You want people to be able to learn to program. But at some point, people have to learn something. And if you're continually removing features or taking out power for favor of the novices, what does that leave to the experts? Or what does that leave to the normal programmers? You have to be maybe 10 times better than your nearest competitor. Or you have to be the product of someone who has a track record. I think the biggest thing that I totally overlooked in my essays on purpose was the idea that maintainability of a program doesn't come from the language. I mean, there are certainly ways a language can hinder maintainability. For example, imagine if you were programming in really, really old C where you had identifier lengths of 6 characters, 8 characters. I mean, there's really no chance for a program above a certain size to get meaningful function names there. You program in a language without namespaces like PHP, versions 4 and 5, you know, you have all these ways to fake up namespaces, but if you screw up, if you mistype something, you know, you might get a collision. There are ways language can hinder that. And a lot of people focus on that when they focus on maintainability, but, you know, if you really look at it, it's not the lack of advanced features that make novices capable of writing bad programs. It's the fact that they're novice programmers. I think the Lisp culture takes pride in being very smart people, but I also don't think the Lisp culture makes it easy for people who aren't naturally very smart people, very mathematically inclined, and expert programmers to become Lisp programmers. The fact that you can do something very concise in Ruby in just a few lines without methods scrolling off the page, file operations, for example, compared to the use of the decorator pattern in file.io in Java. You know, you can do the same things, but look at how little code it is in Ruby versus how much code it is in Java. You know, I think simple code tends to be more beautiful code. I think beautiful defaults really, really help. I mean, if you have code that, if you have an API, for example, that does the right thing by default, you need very little code to use it. If you don't have tools there to abstract that away from you, and you're the type of person who looks at this and says, I'm typing these 4 lines over and over again, why am I doing this? You might find a way to make an abstraction to make that go away, or you change the default so that you never have to do that unless you really, really want to. I guess you find the places where there's pain in your programming language, pain in your API. You get rid of that pain, and you make it simple, And I think beauty and maintainability kind of come naturally after that. What the PUGS project is doing, PUGS is an experimental implementation of Perl 6. It may or may not become official. What the PUGS project does is says, we have this place where you can write a test, and it will probably fail, but that's fine. But if you write a test and it fails, we will fix the bug for you and make it pass. And so you have people coming through the specifications, coming through design documents, coming through the mailing list discussions and looking and seeing what the current state of the design is and saying, okay, we don't have a test for this. I'll write a test for this. I'll run it. It probably fails. It may not even parse, but it's in the test repository now, and it will be in the test repository forever. Here's a starting place to get an executable specification for the language. You know, even before we have a final compiler, we have those. We have, I don't know, probably about 10,000 tests right now. And it's not like, you know, many other languages where you get the idea that the implementer of the language never actually sat down and used it.
Chromatic on Perl 6 and other languages, even the one he might invent someday. Chris Adamson is a frequent contributor to DTF. This week, we went out and just stole something he did, with his permission, of course. Chris has been doing a podcast called The Annotated Alchemist, which provides story analysis and more for each episode of the anime show Full Metal Alchemist. As podcasting develops, I've been thinking more and more about formats and distribution and other constraints and opportunities. Chris has a wonderful description in this week's show of how distribution constraints affect something as fundamental as story arcs in a show. Why do American sitcoms tend to be freestanding stories, while anime episodes can have story arcs that span the entire series? And when would these constraints no longer hold? Chris explains.
A cohesive, long-running story used to be one of the distinguishing traits of anime. Many anime shows are still like this. Full Metal will develop longer and more involved story arcs until the last dozen or so episodes are effectively a serial and not watchable as standalone episodes. But this kind of continuity is no longer a distinguishing trait of anime because more and more television shows are adapting long-running story arcs and greater continuity. And while anime fans might like to think that the long-running stories are an example of artistic purity or a higher respect for the audience, the long-running stories of anime and the episodic nature of older American shows are both based in pure business reasons. The reason that most American shows are episodic in nature is that they're built to rerun. Most people aren't aware that, traditionally anyways, broadcast networks don't make their own programming. They buy it from studios. But they don't pay the studios enough money for the shows to pay for themselves, except in the case of huge hits. That means the studios have to make their money elsewhere, and that usually means through reruns. This explains the importance of sitcoms on American television. They rerun better, since they don't involve long-running stories in which the viewer has an interest in the final outcome. Ideally, a television station could show the episodes of a show in any order, and it would be equally enjoyable. This was really important in the pre-satellite era, when tapes of a show would be couriered from station to station. Since that process was unreliable, it was important that a show's enjoyability not depend on running all the episodes in the right order, because that couldn't be counted on. Even today, that's still a concern for programmers. ABC asked the producers of Alias to stop doing their cool cliffhangers because that required ABC to show the episodes in the right order and made it harder to sell reruns. Anime, on the other hand, isn't built to rerun because most series are generally shown once and never again. They enjoy a nice afterlife on home video, which offers an opportunity to make more money. Moreover, a lot of anime shows base their economic model on tie-in products, Gundam model kits and the like, and the evolving story can be used to drive demand for these products. What, you thought it was a coincidence that the hero's first Gundam would always get destroyed halfway through the series, only to be replaced by a newer, cooler Gundam 5 episodes later? No coincidence there. It's all about pushing swag. And it works. So, I said that continuity was no longer a distinguishing trait of anime. What happened in the West? I think it's that new economic models popped up. The key factors here are the proliferation of cable and satellite television stations, which dilute the market for broadcast reruns and make it less of a big deal. But more important is the rise of the DVD as a format for selling old TV episodes. This allows the studio to make rerun money in a way that doesn't depend on distributing episodes to local TV stations and having them sell ads. In fact, instead of targeting the casual viewer who can go for a simple sitcom if there's nothing else on, the DVD can seek out the serious fan and get more money out of them. It's possible that the breakthrough show here is Fox's 24. The novelty of its season-long continuity seemed risky until people started buying box sets of the first season before the second one started. Even if 24 doesn't work particularly well into reruns, the studio makes its money another way, and they're free to use a more intricate story to hook more devoted fans. And getting back to this episode, it's not like self-contained episodes are unheard of in anime. The immensely popular Cowboy Bebop is mostly one-off stories, with only a little bit of backstory continuity running through the series, particularly near the end. But in general, you tend to see one-off stories early in an anime series, as they establish the characters and style of a show, which is exactly what A Forger's Love does. But when you put a dramatic story in a half-hour format, you get something very atypical in American television. U.S. dramas are pretty much exclusively hour-long affairs. It used to be that all half-hour shows were comedies, and all hour-long shows were dramas. One side of that equation has bent. We now see hour-long shows that are effectively comedies, starting in the 90s with Northern Exposure and Ally McBeal, and continuing today with shows like Desperate Housewives. But you never see half-hour dramas on American TV. And that's interesting because the show that I personally believe to be the best television show ever created, the 1959 to 1964 version of The Twilight Zone, was a half-hour drama. The pace of a half-hour drama is quite different than that of an hour-long drama. In an hour, writers will usually have so-called B-plots and C-plots that run parallel to the main narrative. In a half-hour show, there's no time for side stories, so the narrative is much more focused. In A Forger's Love, the entire focus is on Ed and Elle, seeking out Majahal, learning about the so-called zombies walking around town, and unmasking Majahal's twisted alchemy. At first, their encounters with Klaus seem like a side story, but because her sister was presumably killed by Majahal as part of his experiments, she's really in the A-plot, which is clarified when she enters the lab and is nearly turned into a spirit attachment in the climax. The half-hour drama is a tighter, faster story than the meandering hour-long drama, and it's virtually unknown on American television. Perhaps the only example is if you choose to see each episode of Law & Order as two separate half-hour shows, a police drama followed by a courtroom drama. That's not a completely unreasonable premise. Notice how focused the investigation storyline is. Since they have to catch the bad guy in 22 minutes, it moves with an anime-like narrative speed.
Chris Adamson, editor of Java.net and OnJava.com, from his podcast, The Annotated Alchemist. Thanks also to Chromatic and to Mitch Kapoor. Thanks to all of you who've emailed in your comments, criticisms, and suggestions. If you have ideas to share with us, send email to future@O'Reilly.com. I'm Daniel Steinberg. Distributing the Future is a production of O'Reilly Media. Special thanks to David Bettino for composing and performing this theme. Visit David at Batmosphere.com. This program was produced on Mac OS X Tiger using Soundtrack Pro, Bias Peak, and Audio Hijack Pro.